Let's take our Bibles once again. We'll go to Genesis. We'll pick up the story of Abraham. Genesis, we're going to start actually in chapter 11. We'll go through verse 9 of chapter 12 this morning. Genesis chapter 11, where we'll pick things up this morning. It's interesting that the book of Hebrews talks about Abraham living in tents. He comes from the region of Mesopotamia where the city, Babel, had been constructed. They had built a complex, and their goal was to build up and reach up to the sky, reach up to the heavens, make a name for themselves. God, in this passage, is going to call Abram at this point. He's going to call him to leave that place of permanence and to begin a life of wandering, living in tents. Basically, what God is asking him to do is pull up his tent pegs and get on the move, because changes are in order. So that's where we find this. God promises in chapter 12 that God will give to Abram a name that will be great. He will bless him as a nation. And God gives to Abram everything that the Tower of Babel people had wanted for themselves, but were going to take by might, by force, by cunning, by manipulation. And God says, no, that's mine to give. It requires my grace. Genesis chapter 11, picking up right after the story of the Tower of Babel, we'll begin reading verse 10. We'll read down through chapter 12, verse 9. The Bible says in Genesis 11:10, these are the generations of Shem. When Shem was 100 years old, he fathered Arpachshad 2 years after the flood. And Shem lived after he fathered Arpachshad 500 years and had other sons and daughters. When Arpachshad had lived 35 years, he fathered Shelah. And Arpachshad lived after he fathered Shelah 403 years, and had other sons and daughters. When Shelah had lived 30 years, he fathered Eber. And Shelah lived after he fathered Eber 403 years, and had other sons and daughters. When Eber had lived 34 years, he fathered Peleg. And Eber lived after he fathered Peleg 430 years, and had other sons and daughters. When Peleg had lived 30 years, he fathered Reu. And Peleg lived after he fathered Reu 209 years and had other sons and daughters. When Reu had lived 32 years, he fathered Serug. And Reu lived after he fathered Serug 207 years and had other sons and daughters. Verse 22, when Serug had lived 30 years, he fathered Nahor. And Serug lived and he fathered Nahor 200 years and he had other sons and daughters. When Nahor had lived 29 years, he fathered Terah. Nahor lived after he fathered Terah 119 years and had other sons and daughters. Now when Terah had lived 70 years, he fathered Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Now these are the generations of Terah. If you look back up in verse 10, these were the generations of Shem. This is what happened to the line of Shem. Now we're focusing on one other individual. These are the generations of Terah. This is what's happened for Terah and those who followed him. Terah fathered Abram, Nahor, and Haran fathered Lot. Haran died in the presence of his father, Terah, in the land of his kindred, in Ur of the Chaldeans. And Abram and Nahor took wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife, Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah and Iscah. Now Sarai was barren. She had no child. Terah took Abram his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his grandson, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went forth together from Ur of the Chaldeans to go up to the land of Canaan. But when they came to Haran, they settled there. The days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. Now the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So Abram went, as the Lord had told him. And Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. And Abram took Sarai his wife and Lot his brother's son and all their possessions that they had gathered and the people that they had acquired in Haran. And they set out to go to the land of Canaan. When they came to the land of Canaan, Abram passed through the land to the place at Shechem, to the oak of Moreh. And at that time the Canaanites were in the land. Then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your offspring I will give this land. So he built there an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. From there he moved to the hill country on the east of Bethel and pitched his tent, with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. And there he built an altar to the Lord and called upon the name of the Lord. And Abram journeyed on, still going toward the Negev. So Abram is called upon to pick up his tent pegs, to pitch his tent in a different region, to launch out in a different direction. I don't know, have you ever had to move? How many have ever had to move away from the place where you started growing up? Most. Very good. Some of us are rooted right here in Pennsylvania. Others of us find our roots elsewhere. All right. So when I was growing up, we had about 7 different places that we lived in that I can recall. I remember we started out on a farm, and we moved over to Wisconsin to an apartment. And that was a huge change for a little 3-year-old boy. We had to shoot our dog. That was the worst thing about it. And then we couldn't watch. I remember as a 3-year-old watching the plane, the crop dusters come, 6 o'clock in the morning, and you could see the plane come and fly down the field. And all that land belonged to Grandpa. When I get over to Wisconsin living in an apartment, I couldn't even throw a stone, and I was hitting somebody else's property. It was amazing. There were changes. There's always changes when you move. We moved from an apartment to a trailer house. And during the trailer house, we had 3 or 4 tornado warnings when we were in Minnesota. And so a trailer house has no basement. So when we finally moved from the trailer house to a duplex, whew, there was the sudden relief. When a tornado comes, now we have a basement. But we were living in a duplex downtown, which smashed between other families, and it wasn't very pleasant or enjoyable, especially since the people living next to us decided to fight husband and wife at all hours of the night. And we moved into a nice corner lot, kind of spread out just a little bit, nice and quiet, a beautiful lot, until finally we built our own home. And at that point, I finally got my own room. So that was a blessing. But whenever you move, there's always changes. There's always changes. And I wonder sometimes if in our Christian life, we're afraid of moving forward because moving always means changes. How many like changes? As a kid, I loved moving. I just thought that was the exciting thing to do. I thought everybody did it. You pack up all your stuff. You hope you can find it when you get there. If you don't, you just buy something else because mom and dad just have money, and that's what you do with money. But as a parent, it's a headache because if you lose something, you know you can't just buy something else. Somebody has to earn that money, and all of that headache that goes into it rests on the parent's shoulders. Change can be problemsome. But if we're afraid of change, we won't make the move forward that God has for us in our Christian walk. The proposition this morning is simply this. We cannot move forward in God's story for our lives apart from change. It's not profound. It's rather a simple proposition. But as we look at our lives, we look back over the last 2 weeks, the last month, the last year, can you honestly say that today you are a different person, you are a changed person from what you were 2 weeks ago, from what you were 2 months ago, from what you were 2 years ago? If not, why not? Why is there no change? Because we can only move forward in God's story for our lives as we learn to embrace change. Change ought to be something that marks our lives as Christians. If we were to go to, we're not going to just now, but in Romans chapter 8, verses 28, 29, God says that God will work all things together for good for those who love him, for those who are called according to his what?
Purpose.
Purpose has the idea of that thing that's out in front. What is his purpose? That we would be conformed to the image of his son. Anybody look all like Jesus today? Okay, at least we're humble. And we're honest because we don't. So as long as we don't look like Jesus yet, God's purpose for us is what? Change. Change. So the thing that makes a Christian stand out is that he's constantly on the move. He's constantly putting away the things of the flesh, putting on the things of the Spirit. And as we come to Abraham, we find one who's listed for us, who's called in Romans chapter 4, the father of all who believe. We call him the father of the faith. This is what faith looks like. Faith looks like keeping your eyes focused on a city whose designer and maker is God. Because we know that only there will we be able to finally have our permanent residency. Only there do we let go of the tent pegs and we start building on the blocks that God has established for us. But until then, we're in a tent. We're moving as strangers, as pilgrims, as sojourners in this life that God has called us to. So what does it look like to move forward in God's story? I think this text gives us seven aspects of biblical change. Seven aspects of biblical change. Just look through this very quickly this morning. First aspect of biblical change is that change begins by understanding God's purpose is for blessing. This goes all the way back to Genesis chapter 1. He makes man, he makes woman, he brings them together, he gives them his very first instructions, and his very first instructions are this: be fruitful and multiply. It sums up that instruction. It says, and God blessed them. And he said, be fruitful and multiply. We find that man doesn't do such a good job. By the end of chapter 3, he's kicked out of the garden. In chapter 4, there's two different lines, one who worships God, one who doesn't worship God. By chapter 6, at the beginning, those two lines are starting to come together. They're mixing, they're merging, they're losing their identity. And they become one in their opposition to God, save one man and his family, Noah. God wipes out all of creation with a flood. A worldwide flood, we believe, as the Bible says. And so, there's eight people who are left on planet Earth. And God, in getting them off of the ark, says this: he blessed them and said, be fruitful and multiply. We come to chapter 11, and we see that man, again, refuses to scatter out on the face of the entire world. And so God has to do the scattering, and we have the Tower of Babel story. And that's at the point where we pick up this story. But if you'll notice, this genealogy is a little bit different from other genealogies that we have in the book of Genesis. Look back, chapter 11, verse 10. These are the generations of Shem. When Shem was 100 years old, he fathered Arpachshad 2 years after the flood. He's beginning the be fruitful and multiply process. Verse 11, and Shem what? Shem lived after he fathered Arpachshad 500 years. And what's the next phrase? And he had sons and daughters. Now, all of a sudden, we go from Shem to Arpachshad. Well, what about Shem? Didn't he die? Of course he died. If we were to go back to Genesis chapter 5, this is the book of the generations of Adam, verse 1. The dust clod made in God's image. We come to verse 3. When Adam had lived 130 years, he fathered a son in his own likeness after his image. He named him Seth. The days of Adam after he fathered Seth were 800 years. He had other sons and daughters. All the days of Adam lived were 930, and he died. Verse 8, thus the days of Seth were 912 years, and he died. End of verse 11, and he died. End of verse 14, and he died. End of verse 17, and he died, and he died, and he died, and he died. When we come to this line of Shem, the focus isn't on the death. The focus is on the living. He lived this many years, and he had this son in particular, and then he lived more years. And the living in those years were marked by other sons and daughters, fruitful and multiplying. That is, he bears the mark of God's blessing. And he lives, and he's blessed, and he lives, and he's blessed, and he lives, and he's blessed. That's the emphasis of this genealogy that we have in chapter 10. It's different than what we have in chapter 5 when we're introduced to Adam, the man of death, who brings death upon all men, for all have sin. The emphasis in chapter 11 is on God's blessing. And so it focuses on life, and it focuses on fertility. One of the things that we have to understand, folks, is that when God calls us forward, it may not feel very fun at the start. It may not feel very pleasant. It may not be something that we're looking forward to, this whole thing called change. But before any of us are going to embrace change, we have to get good in our hearts and in our minds that God has your blessing in mind. God wants to bless you. God's purpose is to bless you. And as God calls you to a life of change, He only wants your very best. Why do I not want change? Because I like it right where I'm at. Thank you very much. I'm comfortable. I'm happy. I'm content. I don't need anything more. And God says, yes, you do. You don't know how much you need. My dear child, I'm going to call you forward, and I have your best interest at heart. If we don't have that solidly in our hearts, folks, we will never embrace a life of change. But for those of us who believe that, that's just the starting point. That's what opens the floodgates for us to begin the process called change. Number two, biblical change is threatened by three opposing attitudes. Very quickly, verse 28. We come down, it says, Haran died in the presence of his father Terah, in the land of his kindred, in Ur of the Chaldeans. We're going to be given the story of Abram. We come down, verse 26. When Terah had lived 70 years, he fathered Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Probably not in that order. What we find is that when Abram leaves Haran, he's 75 years old. Terah is 205 years old. That means Terah had Abram when he was about 130. Terah started having children at age 70. Probably Haran was the oldest because Terah's middle son, Nahor, ends up marrying Haran's daughter, Milcah. And so it's not in that order. And what we see from other texts in Genesis is that it generally gives the son that's most significant first, Abraham, because he's the one that matters to us as the Jewish nation that we're dealing with. So he's listed first. So when we're given the story, chapters 12 through 24, of Abraham, what we're given is the life story of the life of one who walked by faith. But before we get to his story, he deals with two other characters. One of those characters is Abram's brother, Haran. Verse 28 tells us what happens to Haran. Haran, what's the second word in there? Died. The focus of this genealogy has been life, blessing. Abraham's connected to life, blessing. He's going to be the recipient of that blessing. This is the first time now in this genealogy that we have those dark words. And he died. We're going to come down to the end of the chapter. We're going to see, and Terah died in Haran. These two characters are going to stand out for us at the very beginning as we look at this life of change where God is calling Abraham to pick up his tent pegs and move forward because God has a purpose to bless him in his life. But before God gives us that story, he deals with the life of Haran. What we find in the attitude of Haran, what we find in the character of Haran, is something that you and I need to guard against in our own lives, because you and I will never embrace change spiritually if what we're holding on to is cultural contentment. You see what the Bible says of Haran? He says he died in the presence of his father, in the land of his kindred, in Ur of the Chaldeans. Wow, that's exactly what God is going to call Abraham away from in chapter 12, verse 1. Go away from your country, away from your kindred, away from your father's house, to the land that I'll show you. But as Haran, this character, and we're not told exactly when Abram received the message. Some translations have verse 1 of chapter 12, the Lord had said to Abram back in Mesopotamia, because in Acts, Stephen says that the Lord had spoken to Abram back in Mesopotamia. So Abram hears the call of God to leave Ur of the Chaldees. Apparently, Terah knew about it, because Terah is the one who's going to pack up the family and start the move. Did Haran know about it? We don't know. We don't know at what point God's call came. But we do know this, that Haran never entered into that life-changing journey. Instead, he stayed on the home fronts. He lived and he died where he was comfortable, where he fit in. You know what? Whenever God calls us to move forward, we're always going to feel like we're not going to fit. And one of the things that holds us back is the fact that we become culturally content. Sometimes that's more dangerous in a conservative setting, because not only do we start to make right choices, but we stop making them in faith. We stop making them because this book tells us we need to make these choices. And we start making the choices that are conservative in our culture because of a fear of what people will think about me. And you know what? We get stuck. And it's a conservative cultural Christianity where this begins to take root and take hold in our hearts. I'm not going to change because I'm not living by faith. In fact, I'm living by the fear of man. What will people think if I, in fact, act so radically? I won't fit in anymore. That's the whole point. So one of the things that fights and works against us is that cultural contentment. We said that Terah was another character that the Bible talks about. Here we have well-intentioned compromise. Look at verse 31. Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his grandson, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went forth together out of Ur of the Chaldees to go to the land of Canaan. Hurrah! That's what they're supposed to do. What's the next word? But when they got to Haran, they settled there. You ever make that commitment? Okay, God, this is what you want me to do. It's change. Here we go. Oh, that wasn't so bad. Then we just kind of get stuck. And we settle there. And God says, whoa, that's not how far we're taking you. I meant for you to go over here. God, I did the whole change thing. I took a step forward. Won't you compromise with me just a little bit? You give a little bit, I'll give a little bit. We're not in the same place that we started. Isn't that good enough? God says, nope, nope. Maybe you've given your life to Christ. There's been that moment where you planted the flag. You were at a Christian prayer meeting. You were at camp. There was some point in your life where you said, God, whatever you want, I'll do. I'll go where you want me to go. It was at the end of a missions conference. You were moved and you said, God, everything on the altar. And then you start to see what that costs. And we come to the reality of Romans chapter 1, Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. I beseech you, therefore, brother, by the mercies of God, that you present your lives a living sacrifice. But the thing about being a living sacrifice is that once we're on that altar, it's so easy to get back off because it hurts so bad. And we start to make the move, but it just hurts too much. One of the things that works against permanent, perpetual change in our lives is the fact that we get stuck with our cultural contentment. Another thing that works against us in changing spiritually is the fact that we're well-intentioned in our change, but we're so prone and given to compromise. I'll give in a little bit if maybe God will let up on some of the demands upon my life. And Jesus says, no, I am Lord. One other thing that would work against us, and often does, comes in verse 30. We see that this genealogy is about life and blessing. We come to verse 30 and look how the narrative is interrupted for us. Now Sarai was barren. She had no child. Noah didn't know about it. He was long dead. Did Abram know about this problem, this situation? Well, of course he did. Okay, Sarai's his wife. There's no children. And God is going to tap him on the shoulder and say, Abram, let's go. I'm going to make of you a blessing. I'm going to make of you a nation. God, that's not my personality. God, that's not my gift set. God, that's not my lot in life. You know, we get so practical in our circumstances. We say, God, I can't be that. Look at me. Look at what I am. I mean, today, really. You want me to be that? There's no way. God, you can't make a nation out of me. My wife is barren. You might not know what that means. That means she can't have kids. God says, I know, and I know why she is, and I'm going to get glory out of all of this. Don't we sometimes say, you know what? I can't do what God calls me to do because I can't, or I'm not. Remember that man? He's in the temple. He has this withered hand. What does Jesus say? Stretch out your hand. What could he have said to Jesus? I can't. What's wrong with you? No. Jesus said, stretch out your hand. And what did he do? He stretched out his hand. Folks, we sang two songs back to back today. Obedience is the very best way to show that you believe. But the only way that we can obey is through grace. Obedience, grace. And if we ever try to obey in our own strength, you know what the answer is? I can't. And you're right, you can't. But when God says, you must. And so Abram doesn't stick in his common sense and say, God, I'm 75 years old. This isn't going to happen. It hasn't happened for the last 40 years. What makes you think it's going to happen now? He just goes. Now, he gets scared along the way, and there's some ups and downs and backs and forths. But he goes, and he starts to make the journey. But these are three attitudes, folks, that are going to keep us. They're going to hound us. They're going to prevent us from engaging in this process of biblical change. Number one, I get culturally content because I'm looking at what man will think of me. Number two, I'm willing and given to compromise. I'll go so far, but no further. Number three, I'm prone to giving myself to practical circumstances. And this can never happen. God would never ask me to do this. There's a Hebrew word for that. It's hogwash, okay? It means get it in gear and get moving because God has a plan to bless your life. It's going to take some change. It's going to take some change. Number three, biblical change is initiated by God's clear instruction. We come down to chapter 12, verse 1. Now the Lord said to Abraham, go. That's one imperative. There's two imperatives here. Go from your country, from your kindred, from your father's house to the land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great. And then the next imperative is found there at the end of verse 2. You must be a blessing. You must go so that you can be a blessing. These two things are tied together. You must be a blessing, but the only way you can be a blessing is if you in fact go. And so these are the two imperatives, and God makes it very clear to Abraham what he expected. He says, go, Abraham, from your country, that is, from your security, from everything you know, everything you love, everything that's familiar, everything that you've surrounded yourself with and grown accustomed to. Anybody been overseas? When you get overseas, it doesn't take real long for a new culture to kind of rub against your grain. Why? Because it's just not the way you do things. At the end of about 2 weeks, it stops being fun and it starts to be burdensome. Okay, I'd just rather sleep on an American mattress. I'd just rather not let everybody else eat out of my bowl for just one meal. I remember being over in China. I was just wishing for one place where I could sit down on a cushion, not a stone or a bench. I just wanted something soft to rest my body on. we're creatures that love our comforts, and we're comfortable with the things that we're most familiar with. And God says, you know what? Everything that you're familiar with, everything you're comfortable with, everything that you know and love, I'm asking you to leave. That's a big thing. I don't think God could ask a bigger thing. Go from your country. Go from your kindred, that is your identity, everything that you prize about yourself, everything that you identify yourself by, everything that everyone knows you as a part of, where you fit in society, you're no longer going to fit there. And then he says, go from your father's house. That is, that inheritance that you have your eyes set on, that place in your culture, that place in your society, and all of that inheritance that rightly belongs to you, I want you to turn your back on it and walk away. What an amazing thing. God is asking Abram at this point to do something that's absolutely astounding. Can you imagine? God says, I want you to go. Leave everything you're secure with, you're comfortable with, you're familiar with, you're identified by, and go. Leave it behind. Is that going to require some change? Ho-ho-ho! To say the least. But when God speaks, he gives clear instruction. It won't necessarily be comfortable. It won't necessarily be complete instruction. Look what he says there. End of verse 1. Go to the land that I... Well, God, now wait a minute. I'll go. Just tell me what I'm in for, and so I know what to expect. Don't you wish God would work that way with you sometime? Thy word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my... Man, I wish he would give a superhighway and light that whole thing so I could see all the way to the finish line. Then I'd know what to expect along the way. But he doesn't do that. It's a narrow way, and it's not exactly broad. It's not exactly... It doesn't follow all the contours that I think it ought to... But he says, you know what? If you follow me, I'll show you where to place your next step. Where to place your next step. That's what it means to walk by faith. So God makes his will clear for us. This is what you must do. And then he makes it clear, but he doesn't make it clear all the way out. He just says, this is what you need to do next. So he gives you enough information, but it's not complete information. So Hebrews 11 verse 8, we read it, says, so he went out, not knowing where he was. Don't you love GPSs? I love getting in the car, plugging in the Garmin, and saying, okay, not only do I know how I'm going to get there, but I am going to get there at 11:26 a.m. Good. Phew, I don't have to worry about anything. God doesn't give us a Garmin when he gives us a command. He says, you don't need a Garmin because you have me, and I will never leave you nor forsake you. Better than a Garmin. Does it provide the same security? Yes, once we get to know who it is that's doing the saying. When God gives us this clear instruction, it won't necessarily be comfortable, won't necessarily be complete, but it will always be accompanied by grace. Verse 2, Abraham, here's what I want you to do. But let me tell you what I'm going to do. I will make of you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. I will those who dishonor you, I will curse. In you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Abram, this is what I am going to do. Yes, you've got a responsibility, but I'm sovereign. And those two things are going to work together in a way that you're going to find fascinating, because at times along your journey, it's going to look like things are out of control. There's going to be a famine in the land, and you're going to go down to Egypt. And you're going to knuckle, you're going to buckle, you're going to give your wife to Pharaoh. But you know what, Abram? I've said that from her womb will come your seed, my blessing. I won't let anything happen. I'm sovereign. I'm in control of everything. Now, sometimes it doesn't look like that. You've got responsibility, but you don't have sovereignty. That belongs to me. Abram, you have to obey, but I'm in charge. I'm going to go with you. I'm going to make sure things turn out. I'm going to make sure that you're blessed, that you receive the blessing that I've promised. I will make of you a great nation. God will see to it that when you start out alone, you will not end alone. You ever feel like if I make this move, if I make this transition in life, if I start to change, I'm going to lose everything I have. I'm going to be all by myself, absolutely alone. God says, Abram, I'm going to give you a nation. Remember when Peter asks Jesus, you said that man has to give up all his wealth. Now, we've given up everything, Jesus, to follow you. What does Jesus say? Nobody who's given up houses or lands or father or mother or wife or children won't receive 100-fold in this life and in the life to come. You know what he's telling Abram? Abram, you feel absolutely alone, just you and me as you take this step. But where this journey ends, there's going to be a whole bunch of people. You're going to be gathered with your people is how the story is going to end with those very words. He says, you're not going to be alone for long. He says, I will bless you. That is, God will superintend that all things in your path will accomplish God's purpose for you. Now, they don't look like they will. And so Joseph has to say, you meant it for evil. That was your intent. But God meant even the bad for my good. God says, I'm going to bless you. My purpose is to bless you. And along the way, I will give blessings. I will coordinate this. I will make your name great. That is, God will preserve his story through you for the benefit of others. At some point, the Hebrew nation understands Abraham, the father of our faith, the father of our nation. Father Abraham had many sons. I am one of them, and so are you. You've all sung that song that has nothing to do with anything. We just swing our arms down in junior church. But Father Abraham, everybody knows. Why? Because everybody knows the story of Abraham. And it's not the story of Abraham, is it? It's the story of God at work through Abraham. That's why I love reading Christian biographies. We just finished the life of Charles Spurgeon. We just started the life of Amy Carmichael as a family. I love reading about Christians in the past. You know why? Not because primarily they're my example, though I look to them as an example. But the bigger thing is they exemplify who my God is. The life of Charles Spurgeon is the story of God at work in the life of a man who is willing. The life of Amy Carmichael is the story of God at work in the life of a woman who is willing to be used. And you know what the promise is, folks? If you say yes to God to change, to be moved from your comfort, from your compromise, from your security, God says, if you will let me have your life, I have a story to tell through you that I want to make my name known to others. That's an amazing thing. How do we know that that's what's going to happen? Because in just a little bit, we're going to see that God's work in your life is always for the benefit of others. It's never just about you. See what he says at the end of verse 3? In you, all families of the earth will be blessed. His two imperatives, go so that you will be a blessing. You must be a blessing. He's connecting these two things together. He says, Abram, I've called you out of all these idol worshipers, you as an idol worshiper. I'm taking you to myself, called election. I'm choosing you out for myself. When we think of election, we often think of exclusivity. I'm choosing these and not these. Election doesn't work that way. Okay? Election works this way. I'm choosing these so that when they obey, when they're obedient, when they follow my plan, I can open up my invitation to all of these. Whenever God chooses somebody to save somebody, he always chooses somebody to become his servant, to become his channel of blessing in drawing others in, not in excluding others from. And so, as God says, Abram, this is what you need to do. You need to begin a life of change so that I can write my story through your life. And as I do that, I am using you to open up my blessings to others. When God calls you to obedience, folks, it's never just about you. And you can think, well, I'm not going to do that. This is just between me and God. It's never just between you and God. Guys, you go out and you buy that new car. You forgot to tell your wife about it, okay? It's never about just you and the new car, is it? We understand that when it comes to a husband-wife relationship. Okay? The choices that you make impact others. My choices of obedience always impact others. And so we come down to 1 Timothy. Go there for just a second. 1 Timothy chapter 4. Paul is writing to Timothy, who's given his life to Christian service, missionary service. Paul says to him in chapter 4, verse 12, "Let no one despise your youth, but set for the believers an example in speech, in conduct, in love, in faith, in purity. Until I come, devote yourself to the public reading of Scripture, to exhortation, to preaching. Don't neglect the gift that you have, which was given to you by prophecy when the council of elders laid their hands on you. But practice these things. Immerse yourself in them so that all may see your movement forward, so that everybody can see that you are in the process of being changed." Verse 16, "Keep a close watch on yourself, on your teaching. Persist in this, because in doing this, you will save both yourself and those who are watching you." Folks, when God puts his finger on his life and he says, "This is what I want you to do. You must obey me." And you say, "No, thank you very much. This is just between me and you." We're absolutely mistaken, because this affects everybody around us. Biblical change is about moving forward. The fourth aspect of biblical change is that biblical change always looks like obedience. God gives clear instruction, and that instruction needs to be obeyed. So verse 4, very simply, Abraham went. Just like God told him, Abraham went. Our change is always responsive to God's speaking in our life. But the change is not limited by our life circumstances. We look at what follows here. Abraham went, just like God told him. And Lot went with him. "God, I can't go. I've got Lot. The poor kid, his dad died. God, what am I supposed to do with Lot?" "Bring him with you." "Okay, well, so Lot went with him. Well, Abraham was 75 years old. "God, I can't go. I'm too old for this kind of thing." God says, "Abram, you're 75 years old, and I'm expecting you to go." So he was 75 years old, and he went. And Abraham took Sarah, his wife, Lot, his brother's son, all their possessions, and all the people that they acquired in Haran. We don't know what that means. It probably doesn't mean slaves. That word isn't usually used in that capacity. It may be the household that had children, some of the servants that had children during that time. It may be, and more than one commentator speculates this, it may be that while he was in Haran, he was preaching and telling others about what his God had told him. And others were proselytized. They joined in and said, "Man, that's your God? Let us come too." And several commentators think that this may be those who've joined in with his caravan. In following God, he's already making an impact. But change is not limited by our circumstances. Change will affect your current relationship with others. Let me say that again. If God is going to change you, it must affect your relationship with others. One of the things that I haven't done as a spiritual discipline, I don't know ever, is fasting. And the reason is this, and I'm just telling, it's not that it's right. This is just what I've done. I've never taken time to seriously fast and pray because I didn't want it to affect my family at mealtime. What's Dad doing? How come Dad's not eating supper with us? He's fasting and praying. Well, yeah, I don't want that. And I'm not saying that it's right. I'm just saying one of the things, if I were to begin the discipline of fasting, that's going to affect necessarily those that are closest to me. Sweetheart, you go to bed. I'm going to stay up and pray. Kids, you're going to have to eat with your mother tonight because I'm in praying. You're going to have to eat by yourselves tonight because your mother and I are in praying. You know what? All of us are going to skip meal tonight because us as a family are going to pray. Whenever we take steps of obedience, folks, just get ready for it to affect those around you. It's supposed to, and it must. Change will affect your current relationships. For Abram, it was Sarah. It was Lot. It was the people that were with him in Haran. And change will have definite results. Come down to the end of verse 5. So they set out to go to Canaan. What's the next verse? When they came to Canaan, here's what happened. Praise God. When he calls you to go, he brings you there. He's not going to leave you stranded halfway. He's not going to leave you in Haran, though you want to settle in Haran. He's not going to let you stay there because he has a purpose in your life that he wants to accomplish. Number five, biblical change does not come without difficulty. You get down to verse 6, and it says, Abram passed through the land to the place of Shechem. Shechem is located in a valley between two mountains, Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. These two mountains are the mountains that God says in Deuteronomy chapter 27, when you get into the land, come to Shechem, stand one half of you on Mount Gerizim and record the blessings. The other half of you stand on Mount Ebal and recite the curses. Because it's at this place that I want you to make a decision. You are choosing between life and between death, between blessing and between cursing. And this is where Abram comes. He's made the decision. It says he came not just to Shechem, but to the oak at Morah. The word Morah means teaching. And probably what this was, it was an oak, probably not a plane, as some translations have it. It was an oak, a large tree that they would use as kind of a center of education, of teaching, of passing on pagan doctrine. And then the next words are, and the Canaanite was in the land at that time. We know what the Canaanites are. They're sexually perverse people. They're morally corrupt people. And Abraham comes in the middle of their land. In fact, he comes to the place where they're propagating their pagan ideology. And God says, this is where I want you to be. Don't you ever just want to pack up your family and move to Wyoming or Montana, maybe northern Canada, so you don't have to deal with the filth and the smut of what we have here in the States today? You know what? God says, you're not going to get away from it. In fact, this is the very place that I want you to be. I want you to be my light in a dark. You're in the world. You're not of the world. But as we move forward, change doesn't come without difficulty. These Canaanites represent the place of opposition. It's a perverse and hostile culture toward faith. And this what? That's what we live in. A perverse and hostile culture toward faith. And yet, that's where God calls us to make those changes in our lives. Two more and we're done. Number six. Biblical change requires revisiting the revelation. Verse 7. They're in the land. In the land, the Lord appears to Abram and says, to your offspring, I will give this land. You know, along the way, we kind of tend to lose sight. It's been a long journey, over 500 miles that Abram's traveled up to this point, just from Haran. And so he gets into the land. He is where he's supposed to be. He's not finding it as easy as he thought it might be. It's not just rosy along the way. And it's there that God meets with him again and says, you're on the right track. Keep going. And oftentimes as we make those decisions, we tend to feel all alone, all by ourselves, and we cry out to God. And the one thing we don't do is we don't go back to this book and open it up. Mike was going through the book of Ecclesiastes this morning at the end of Sunday school. He said one really important thing at the end, and I don't know if you caught it or not, but he said, the only way you can understand some passages of Scripture is to read the whole thing. What do we do in our comfortable, conservative Christian culture? Okay, what are my 10 verses for today? What did the daily bread have for me? Okay, that's my devotions. I got my one verse. I got my lucky charm. Folks, sometimes we've got to get in this book and we've got to read page after page after page. Well, that's not fun. That means you might have to turn off your TV. It means you might have to walk away from your computer. You might have to log off of Facebook. You might have to open this book and actually read. Not have somebody read it to you, but read. Because the thing that you need most to keep you on the path that you've chosen to go by God's grace is you need more grace. And God gives His grace in this book. Last aspect of change, of biblical change, is this. Biblical change always results in God receiving the glory. God shows up there in verse 7. What does Abram do? So he built there an altar to the Lord. From there he moved to the hill country on the east of Bethel. He pitched his tent with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. What a beautiful word picture. We don't quite catch it. Bethel, the house of God, the place of God, Ai, the heap of ruins. Abram, as he comes into the promised land, he's not all the way there. God didn't give him even a place for the sole of his foot, Stephen says. He's right now in the middle of leaving behind everything as an ash heap and looking forward to the place, the city of God. That's where he finds himself. Folks, that's where you and I find ourselves today. And God says, don't stop. I've got in front of you a city whose builder and maker is God. I have a purpose for you that looks like none other than my son, Jesus Christ. But it means you've got to take the first step. You've got to realize that you're not just yet where you need to be. We cannot move forward in God's story for our lives apart from change. I like how John Phillips says it. God speaks, we believe, faith dawns, life begins.